Hi, you're listening to the FakeShemp.net podcast. My name's Glenn.
I'm Jarrett.
And he's...
not here this evening.
No, Mr. Sean Crawford, the resident Scott, is no longer with us.
But I believe we'll hear from him from beyond the grave, maybe later on this evening.
No, he's a little bit ill, so he's home resting, and we'll have him back soon, back in action. But in the meantime, thanks for listening, and let's kick this sucker off.
First you want to kill me, now you want to kiss me.
Blow.
Hey, you've got 3 seconds for it.
I'm going to amp this baby up, see how it sounds.
It's a monster movie, and it's not a very good monster movie, but that's okay because most monster movies aren't very good.
And you can listen to us on iTunes, Podbean, and Stitcher. Interact with us on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube. But for now, let's get cracking. We've got a focus film on this episode, the 1982 cult film Extro. Looking forward to that.
It's a WTF movie.
It sure is. Let's talk about that in a little while.
Totally.
Let's get to some somber news for the time being. 2016's been taking a lot of people away from us.
Yeah.
And Mr. Gene Wilder left last week.
Yeah, tragic.
It came from nowhere. I mean, he was old.
I know. And the fact that obviously that he and the family had kept his, you know, his illness a secret.
Yeah.
For all the right reasons.
Yeah.
It's kind of beautiful. But yeah, it's a tragic loss. Although I do have a theory that it maybe wasn't complications due to the disease. I think Zac Hepburn might have been involved because tomorrow night at the Astor, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory is playing. I mean, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Yes.
Charlie and the Chocolate Factory is playing. Well, yeah, that's... sad. But yeah, Willy Wonka, how's that? Playing at the Astor tomorrow night. Do you imagine that's going to be a sold out session?
That would have to be.
It's going
to
be crazy.
That's, I mean, good timing. But
timings, yeah. I mean, to see it on the big screen again. But yeah, it's truly tragic news.
It is.
And ViVision are just about to release See No Evil, Hear No Evil and Stir Crazy on Blu-ray locally. Yeah. So I mean, yeah, it's just really odd. But it's a great time to celebrate his life. Yeah. And this isn't people capitalising on his death. It's just great to have things.
I must admit, the outpouring of, you know, love and grief and all that has been far greater than I would have expected for Gene Wilder. I mean,
we know
he was a legend, but it's being felt, obviously, there's just Willy Wonka fans. And
yeah, absolutely.
Anyone that doesn't know him the way we do, like in a film sense, would know him just from that one role.
Totally.
You know, but then we've got things like Blazing Saddles and, you know, Young Frankenstein.
Oh, of course, yeah.
So many great films. The Producers, for God's sake.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So it's been a big loss, but...
But have you seen the meme that's doing the rounds? You know how there's always been the Willy Wonka meme where he's standing there and says, "So tell me," and this one says, "So tell me, you've been a Gene Wilder fan for how long now?" And it's so funny. It's this kind of meta meme.
Yeah.
So you kind of got to laugh. But yeah, what an honest talent like it is.
Yeah. And how's this for wig? There's two other people have died since we recorded last. Arthur Hiller, the director.
Right, of See No Evil, Hear No Evil.
He directed See No Evil, Hear No Evil and Silver Streak with Gene Wilder.
Oh, yeah, of course,
right?
Yeah.
And then David Huddleston died, who was in Blazing Saddles.
Jeez.
And he was, if you don't know who he's in The Big Lebowski, and he was Santa Claus in Santa Claus the Movie.
Right, yeah.
You know, and so it's all these closely knit people have just sort of passed away. And I made a really, really poor taste joke at work. Probably 2 weeks ago.
I did before about Zac Hepburn. Yeah. It wasn't even intended to be a joke, but anyway, so do go on. I feel guilty. So share your guilt.
Well, I just turned around to someone I work with and I said, you know, so when's Mel Brooks going to die? And then like a week later, it's Gene Wilder. I'm like, whoa, he dodged that bullet. You know?
Yeah, wow.
I feel a little bit guilty.
Do you know the night before...
Christmas?
The night before the movie with Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Seth Rogen. It's Sunday night, because it was Monday the news came out about Gene Wilder's passing. Yes, yeah, so Sunday night. I think it was Saturday night I watched The Dream Team with Christopher Lloyd, Michael Keaton, Peter Boyle.
Yes.
And that led me to want to watch Young Frankenstein on Sunday night, but we just ran short of time, because I think we went to the movies.
Yeah.
So we fell short on time, and it was just like a bit eerie. You know, you've had that before too.
Of course.
You've watched the film the night before, or contemplated watching it the night before, and then that's happened the following day.
And the funny thing too is Dream Team is a much more comedic version of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Oh, absolutely.
Gene Wilder got his start in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Absolutely.
So
it's crazy, isn't it?
Crazy. But I think also since we recorded, Michael Cimino has died.
Mm. What? Really?
Yeah.
No, I didn't hear about this. Yes. When did this happen?
A couple of weeks ago.
Wow, that was really quiet.
Yeah.
I didn't see any sort of outpouring via Facebook or social media.
And of course, Kenny Baker.
Yeah.
Little R2-D2.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. That was... Yeah. We're losing all the little people this year. We lost old mate that played Elf. What was his name again?
Old mate that played Elf.
Yeah, you know, old mate from Waxwork.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Who was that?
Played Elf in the 80s. Don't know, doesn't matter.
I do remember hearing that.
My condolences, little sir. But I guess moving on, let's get away from death. Let's get to some happiness. So a point I just wanted to quickly raise with you is the fact that Netflix want to self-classify, like commercial broadcasters, TV stations self-classify their content.
Yep.
Netflix want to self-classify their content and not wait for it to pass through the classification board.
Right. So they want authority to rate their
content. Absolutely. Which I'm a little bit like, you know, the rating board exists for a reason, sure, but it's a bit antiquated when you think how hard it is to buy a DVD or Blu-ray. You know, to buy it online, you basically need a credit card. To buy it in store, you need to, you know, deal with someone face-to-face. So getting an MA 15 plus film or an R film is more difficult than streaming it.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't really understand the politics behind it, but I can't help but feel that they'll probably get their way, just like the commercial networks are getting their way with shutting down community TV and turning it into another bloody...
You're right.
You know,
and I guess too, like if Netflix get their way and they are going to classify their own films, then they will have to put some kind of parental lock mechanism in there.
Yeah, I mean, I think it exists at the moment, but like we've said before, parents aren't being, you know,
supervising their kids at all times, and
absolutely.
The kids can log in and watch.
Absolutely.
I know that's how it is in my house. Yes. Anyone can access it. We've got, you know, four individual accounts on Netflix.
Yeah.
Strange stuff.
Another thing.
Yeah.
Netflix Australia, at least.
Yeah.
You know, apart from the original programming and the movies, which are being really drip-fed at the moment. I mean, we're really excited about an upcoming film that's coming up on Netflix in October.
Mascots.
But I'm just disappointed with the back cat of stuff on Netflix. Like, Stan's good, but they don't add enough content regularly enough.
Yeah.
Honestly, Crackle, man, I find myself going back to Crackle, and they have got more older, cool back cat films than either Stan or Netflix. It's,
you know, the problem I find, even with good back catalogue, is there's so much of it there that it's hard to choose. Like, I will think, I'm going to watch some Netflix tonight.
Yeah.
And I will scroll looking for something for like half an hour.
Scroll.
And by the end of scrolling, I'm not in the mood anymore.
No, I hear you. Yeah, yeah.
You
just kill the desire to do so. What I do is if I'm like, I have to watch something, I can't sit here and scroll, I'll go to the list, mainly with Stan more so than Netflix.
Yeah.
My Netflix list is a bit shit at the moment, but my Stan list has seen me hit up like 2 James Spader films back to back, Bad Influence and Dream Lover recently, and I was fucking, that was all after the New Kids. I've been on like a James Spader mid 80s to early 90s kick.
Well, that was my mistake, because I don't really compile lists on there, so maybe I'll start doing that.
Yeah, just throw it in the list.
Speaking of James Spader, I was talking to a lady the other day that's really into Blacklist.
Right, okay, yeah.
She had no idea that he was like a pin-up boy from the 80s.
Ugh.
Who didn't know that?
That's crazy. So you just thought he's been a kooky, bald, you know, funny guy.
Yeah, I had to go and find a DVD cover to show her that, well, hang on a second, have a look at this hunk, you know?
It's amazing. But another point I will raise, watching all these James Spader films, in fact, you can find 5 James Spader films on Stan, including Supernova, that sci-fi.
Yes. The one Francis Ford Coppola ghost directed.
Absolutely, that one.
Yep.
James Spader. Early 80s through to late 80s, pretty much played a prick. Most of the time played a prick. A preppy, yuppie kind of prick in some manner. Then he started wearing the glasses in the late 80s, early 90s. Started playing...
Like Stargate and...
You know,
like
either the nerdier roles.
Yeah.
Or like Dream Lover, where he's like, you know, sort of a... You know, a businessman.
He became sympathetic.
Absolutely. It's a strange transition to see this actor go through so many, you know, changes throughout their career right up until now. And I don't know where his hair went too, because I swear I watched a lot of Boston Legal and he was rocking a full head of hair.
Must have been
a hairpiece.
Yeah.
Must have been. But I fucking love James Spader.
I do too. So do you think, like you said, transition from arrogant, sort of smug, to endearing almost?
Yeah.
Wolf was sort of around about that came just like, after the transition, and he went back.
That
to
was
being
yeah,
a
that yeah, absolutely. That was like what, 93 or so. 94, so yeah, I think he almost had that you know, that resurgence into the prick role. But yeah, and now I guess he's relegated to TV, you know, had kind of a comeback with Boston Legal, then went slightly back into obscurity, Nowhereville again. Yeah. I think he was doing some B movies, in fact, like an Alien Hunter or something like that.
Yeah, could be.
And then, yeah, and then, you know, just kicked back off with Blacklist and sands his hair.
Yeah, strange. Yeah. There's a movie in itself.
I know, but he's a, you know, he's one of those actors I'd like to work with. I think he would be, you know, I think he'd be, yeah, really interesting to work with. Like Christopher Walken.
If you were to make a movie with James Spader and you were doing, like, bringing an old character from the 80s back and catching up with him in a new movie, which...
Less than zero. Because he's such a fucking, like, a dark, evil character and, you know, really sends Robert Denny's, you know, Robert Denny Jr.'s life into a downward spiral.
I love how you just had that answer, like, there. We didn't even plan that.
But you don't want to see him play. I want to see him play in, like, a rom-com. But not... And him be his sort of, you know...
sympathetic character.
You know, but yeah, I want to see him play that kind of role. And, you know, with his quick wit.
Is he too old for it?
I don't know if it can happen now.
Cocoon 3?
But they put the wig on him again. Yeah. Oh, that'd be great. But you'd have to get Steve Guttenberg back for it.
Yeah, you would.
He needs a gig.
Oliver Barrett looking like a hippie. All right, so we've got some exciting news. We are returning to the Melbourne Underground Film Festival on September 16th.
Indeed.
We have got an awesome, what I'm calling a splat and slash double feature. We've each picked a film to screen.
Yeah.
So my choice was 100 Tears, the Marcus Cook film, which is a splatter film about a clown. It's got plenty of gore, plenty of splat, and you, of course, have chosen...
The 1990 Australian cult slasher classic, well, at least in my books, Blood Moon.
Blood Moon.
Which... shot in my high school back in 89, a year before I went to Marist College Ashgrove, and I've had a bit of a love affair with this film ever since I saw it as a 10-year-old on video. And I'm excited to say that we've gone and reinserted the fright bake into the actual film itself. So much shorter than the original fright bake, but it's in there nonetheless. And yeah, no, I'm really excited about actually seeing it on a big screen. So I've never seen it on a big screen.
So to give people a little bit of information about the fright break, it was a pause in the film that allowed people the opportunity to leave and get their money back.
Absolutely.
Should the film be too terrifying.
Yeah.
And I believe from what Mr. Michael Helms has suggested on Facebook recently is that they had a chicken corner.
Yes.
For people that had friends with them.
Yeah.
They could wait in the chicken corner for their friends to finish the film.
Yeah.
I wonder if anyone ever went that far.
I want to see some photos of it. Yeah. Like, I've read it in a few different places, but I'd love to see a photo of that.
So we're bringing it back to the big screen. We invite all of you to come along September 16th at the Backlot Studios. Tickets are available on muff.com.au, and we're super stoked. So come along and see us present these, because we'll get up there and talk a little bit.
And we're actually showing a high def print of Blood Moon, which so far the film hasn't been released in high definition digitally or on Blu-ray clearly, or 4K for that matter. So rather than, you know, going anywhere else in Melbourne and checking out films that you can check out on DVD or Blu-ray already, why not come and have a look at Blood Moon and 100 Tears, which has not even had an Australian home end
not
release
only
yet.
Has 100 Tears not had a release in Australia, now's the perfect opportunity because Marcus Cook has just announced 100 Tears Part 2. So Gertie the Clown is coming back, and this is your opportunity to see the first one on the big screen.
It's amazing.
So come along.
I'm sold. I'll be there.
Tony's father has been away a long time. Now, he's coming home.
Why did you come back?
I came back for you.
Extro, bearing black magic from outer space. His mission, to avenge, to possess, to destroy. Extro. Some extraterrestrials aren't friendly. From New Line Cinema, rated R.
And that, of course, was the trailer for the 1982 cult film Extro, which Jared has brought to this podcast.
Haven't I indeed? Dug that one out of obscurity.
This is the biggest case of what the fuck did I just
see?
Isn't it? You know, I've seen this film when I was young, but it's been so long that I don't remember much of it. And in fact, I think the cover art for the Australian VHS stuck in my mind more than the film did itself. So this was essentially like me seeing it for the first time, and my... God, like, what the hell was that?
It is. It is a what the fuck movie.
But it's like, it's really good.
It's nightmarishly good.
It is the most fucked up, surreal, bizarre.
It's very nightmarish though, and very dreamlike in that not everything makes sense. But fuck, it's terrifying.
I haven't even got any notes to work off here because it just sort of. Let's firstly talk about the director. It was directed by Harry Bromley Davenport. He also made the films Erasable You, Mockingbird Don't Sing, and Haunted Echoes, as well as Extro.
Watch the Skies.
Extro 2 and 3.
Yeah.
Which he did two sequels that were completely unrelated to this one. Some of you may know the cover art from the 80s with this...
The gnarly, classic Thorny Amaya cover.
Gnarly cover. Little alien creature with pointy teeth. Or there was the one which you can see on our banner on our...
Yeah, the American poster.
Yeah, on our Facebook page. And how do you explain this film? Do you want to give some kind of summary?
Yeah, look, that's going to be really tough. A little boy... a little boy is left by his father at an early age to be raised by his mother and her boyfriend.
Yeah.
He returns about 3 years after with no memory of where he's been, but we've actually seen him potentially come from outer space and then be reborn out of a woman that was orally raped by an alien creature. And yeah, he sort of tries to re-assimilate with the family and that kind of goes haywire because he ends up sucking eggs into his son's body. Then his son gets telekinetic. It's just too bizarre. And that's the normal part. That's the normal part.
Yes.
There's so much crazy. There's a midget clown in it, if that's the correct term for it. I guess it was in 82.
Yeah.
There's a snake in a salad.
It's part body horror.
Yeah, absolutely. There's definitely Cronenberg influences from Shivers through The Brood.
Yeah.
And even a little bit of Rabbit in there. There's definitely that body horror sort of Cronenberg elements to
it. Kind of also playing on the recent success of E.T.
With the tagline, absolutely. Not all extraterrestrials are friendly.
And I don't know, I'm trying to think what other influences. There's a lot of European influences in here.
Yeah.
I know.
Well, there's an element of possession about it too. Yeah. Although that was made, I think, about a year prior, so don't think it was a direct influence, but it could have been what was happening across Europe at that point in time.
And I know in 82 it was a long time before Hellraiser, but there's so much in there that feels Hellraiser-ish. Yeah, it's
definitely got that.
The lead actress feels like, the lead actress, from Hellraiser. And a Hellraiser connection is that there's a guy that played the monster in the film.
Right.
I know a lot of it was Puppet.
Oh, okay, but
another part played by a guy called Tim Dry, who was from an electro pop band burlesque band in the 80s called Shock.
Right. With
Barbie Wilde, who was from Hellraiser.
Okay.
So and not to mention Sean Crawford, the guy from the main guy.
Who normally does the podcast.
Is there a Sean Crawford in this?
Yeah.
Well, he was also with Barbie Wilde in this Shock electro
group. Okay.
So they had that little Hellraiser connection, which is it's a complete side.
Weird side sort of story. I was going to mention, too, it almost even has a very David Lynch Eraserhead feel about it.
Definitely.
It's just such a strange piece of work. It's a really accessible art house sort of surreal horror film.
If you've ever seen Eraserhead and you think about the woman with the slugs, that's the thing about it that reminds me, that kind of what the fuck is
and this? The chicken and that, the whatever it is, the roast chicken that comes out of the oven that's sort of pulsating and still
oh my god. Anyway, this film just completely, I kept looking at you and saying I just can't believe what I'm watching here, and this is a film made 1982 and I'm still responding that way going what the hell.
I know, and it's just done so well too, because it never becomes stupid and absurd. It just remains sort of surreal. Interesting thing that I heard the director had said in the actual featurette that's on the Extra 1 and 2 DVD is that it was never they never intended it to be that weird. It's just they kept coming up with ideas and
tacking it on,
and things would just become part of it, right down to Bob Shea, Robert Shea from New Line, who was one of the producers on the film and visited and said that they should have a panther in the film.
And there is a panther in the film.
And the other interesting thing we noticed when we started watching the film is that there's about four screenwriters and then someone who wrote some additional dialogue, but the screenplay was based on an original screenplay. So it feels like there's a lot of people that have brought a lot of ideas.
It feels
to the table.
Like this film was something different to begin with, and it's morphed. Like it's, you said, they've added stuff, but I think it sort of grew before production. You
know, yeah,
like in the writing stage, yeah. It sort of started becoming twisted and. Ah, far out.
It's very strange. And weirdly enough, hearing Harry talk about the film on the featurette, he doesn't. It's not that he's not proud of the film at all, but he's just sort of, I don't know why it works, sort of thing. And it's just sort of ridiculous. But yeah, I don't know. It just happens. And,
so, what made you want to choose this one? I almost feel like this should have been like in an obscurity.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Yeah, true. I just feel like it's this cult film that never really gets its, you know, due attention. All these people that collect, you know, the VHS, you often see it pop up on the video forums and the cover art pops up and I'm like, you know, it's one of those just, it's just a weird one that a lot of people know about or maybe they saw some time ago, but they can't really recall it. And yeah, I think it just needs to be discussed, if anything, just for the whole WTF angle and the fact that it preceded so many of those type of films that would come decades later, because it is art and it's surreal, but it definitely wasn't made as an artistic statement. It was made as an exploitation film. It's just over time it's really become.
Yeah. Do you know what actually really struck me the most? I mean, obviously I was wondering what the hell I was watching, but I was really drawn into the drama of it. Yeah, like the moment where the previous husband comes back. And then suddenly there's this dynamic of, well, he's in the house with the new partner and the wife's stuck in the middle between these two men. She doesn't know which one to turn to.
True, it's like a weird love triangle.
I was really roped into that triangle.
I know, it's a weird drama because it wasn't really forced down your throat, but it was one of the aspects of the film. I think maybe because it was the only real logical part of the story, that and maybe the relationship between the father and the son and the fact that he hadn't accepted the mother's boyfriend is sort of like the father figure. And then there was that weird sort of moment where at the dinner table and he says, "Daddy," and they both go to stand up. I think we were probably taking what little that made sense and clinging to it so that we could deal with everything else.
Which made the drama all that more... potent. But let's talk about the fact that there's so many accents in this film.
Ridiculous. Within the opening, within the one household, there's four different accents.
You've got this really, really strong Cockney accent in this child, and neither of his parents have Cockney accents.
No,
Then you've got a French woman, you've got, what else we got? You've got,
Well, you've got the, you know, the quite proper spoken mother who's, you know, British. Then you've got the neighbour downstairs who's seemingly completely ADR and she's got an unusual accent again. And then there was the chap that was the, I think it was like the concierge or something like that. And he seemed like he'd been dubbed.
Such a hodgepodgey kind of...
It's very...
ensemble.
Odd. But yeah, it's one of those kind of films where you think it just can't get weirder and it does.
Yeah.
It doesn't even feel like they were trying to up the ante as they went. It's not like, this is fucking crazy, let's take it to the next level. It's just sort of like went there and it just happened.
Yeah.
And that's the beauty of it. And that's what I kind of feel with Possession. It's a very fucking crazy film. Very Lovecraftian. In a way, this has got those Lovecraftian elements to it
definitely
as well.
Definitely does, yeah.
Yeah, it's just such a... It is a strange beast.
It's progressive mayhem, really.
Yeah.
And funny enough, like the iconic poster art really isn't a reflection of the film at all.
No. It's just such a small...
Obviously, it's a catchy...
It's the key selling point.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, it is such an odd duck of a movie.
I'm totally glad you brought it to the podcast. Yeah. It's such a shame Sean wasn't here to,
I know,
to experience it. I would love to have had his take on it.
Absolutely. I don't think he's ever seen it. I really hope that after listening to this podcast that he immediately finds it. And
I really, really want to get stuck into number 2 and 3.
Yeah, look, I have only seen 2 on video back in the very early 90s and... You know, back in those days, like when that came out, it was probably like 11 or 12. I think it was 1990, but it didn't come out in video here till like 91, 92 or so. And to me, that seemed like a fucking lifetime. Like the first one was 82 and I saw it on video probably when I was 4 or 5. I remember seeing it on TV once. In fact, the TV broadcast of it at the end of the program, they used to do like a little spiel, like you've been watching. And it was like, you've been watching Extra, the Outer Coup de Goat. And I always remember it. My dad and I will repeat this every couple of years. It comes up and we're like, like the Outer Coup de Goat. I've tried Googling it.
Yeah.
I don't even know if Outer Coup is an actual word because it doesn't turn up. And I'm not, if I'm spelling it right.
Yeah.
Outer Coup de Goat, who knows? But yeah, so the time between the original and the sequel seemed like a lifetime. And to me, it seemed like far too long. It was like the time between Alligator and Alligator 2, the mutation. So the second one's more of a straight ahead kind of sci-fi action, but very cheesy and cheap in an alien type manner. But it has its value. I've never seen the third film. Now I actually really want to watch that.
I do too. And we found out that Extra 4 is in production. So
incredible.
I know. And that's been a probably even greater gap between films. Mm. Definitely.
Can you imagine if they tried to remake Extra? They'd have to try and just make it like a straight narrative. And it would be boring. Everyone would be like...
Yeah.
Okay.
There'd be no financial interest from backers for a fucked up, weird ass kind of film like it is.
Yeah. Anyway. It mustn't have made enough money because... Robert Shea would have easily have gone, let's make an Extra sequel earlier in the piece.
This is Robert Shea before Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah, this is pre-Nightmare on Elm Street, yeah, 2 years after.
Different frame of mind.
True, yeah, too early in the piece.
No longer, like, this is before he knew what audiences wanted.
Mm.
You know? Mm.
This is when he was wanting possibly just make edgy, strange films, because they had produced... some John Waters stuff as well.
That's right.
Yeah. So it was probably him being a bit of a maverick, and I mean, the 70s was a different era in cinema as the 80s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Well, there you go. Extra.
Roger begins with a horror film called Extra. That's X-T-R-O. Remember that spelling? Remember that name? Our first movie is one of the most mean-spirited and ugly thrillers I've seen in a long time. It's called Extra, and it's a monster movie, and it's not a very good monster movie, but that's okay because most monster movies aren't very good. A lot of them, though, do somehow manage to be entertaining in a dumb, goofy, stupid sort of way just by giving us such ridiculous monsters. Mm-hmm. Extra doesn't even try. Did you ever stop to ask yourself how a civilization develops enough intelligence to come all the way to Earth from another star, and then they don't have enough sense to not stand in the middle of the road when a car is coming along? The movie never bothers to explain much of anything about these monsters. They land, they take over a little boy's father, the little boy has nightmares, he has a pet snake named Harry, his daddy comes back and eats Harry's eggs, and so forth and so on, in a depressing and completely cheerless exercise that leads to an utterly hopeless conclusion. You'd either go to a monster movie because it was good, or maybe because it was entertaining trash, but Extra doesn't even qualify as acceptable trash.
Absolutely. I'm sitting here trying to figure out now which was the most disgusting scene in this picture. Mm-hmm. The one where the father eats the snake eggs?
Yeah, with
no, I don't think so.
Rolling down
I don't think that was the worst. I'd have to say where you see the birth of a man out of a woman's womb. A full-grown man. That's really a nice scene. Really. I always get a kick out of these actors. You know, they've all studied. They all think they're in show business. Uh-huh. I would like to be born on screen with all this garbage all over.
I don't think I'd enjoy it very much. The disgusting thing about this film, though, is that it doesn't even have the courage to admit what it is, which is entertaining matinee trash and let's have a little fun. Instead, the conclusion is so nihilistic, in which the movie basically says, that's it, everybody's going to die, there's no hope, fade to black, let's have the credits. Yeah. It's as if they're so pretentious that they're trying to make some kind of a philosophical statement out of this garbage. It was offensive.
Garbage is the operative word.
It's time for some obscurities.
Obscurity! Obscurity! Bring it, make it happen. I wanted to do something different.
That was different.
And I just made it up as I went, and clearly you could tell.
There was a point halfway through that where you thought, I made a mistake.
Yeah, there was a fatal error in judgment there.
Alright, so who wants to go first? Sean?
Sean!
Hello, boys. Sorry I couldn't make it, but I'm chipping into the podcast as best I can with this, my obscurity for this round. Most people know that Hollywood produces two of everything. For every Dante's Peak, there's a volcano, and for every Armageddon, there's a Deep Impact. And my selection this week is much the same. It's a relatively new film from 2014, and there's a couple of people that probably know about it, but I think more people should, because it was the other version of the Helen Mirren political/thriller Eye in the Sky. This one is called Good Kill, starring Ethan Hawke and January Jones. It was directed by Andrew Niccol, and it was released in Australia, at least with very little fanfare, and it's a shame because it's actually a really good film. Taking the story of Ethan Hawke, who plays a drone pilot for the American Air Force, he has a battle of conscience because he starts to question everything that he's doing for the military, whether it's legitimate in terms of there's no face-to-face combat and is it honorable or is it sneaky. And when he's asked to push the roles a little bit more, it distances himself, it forces him to distance himself from his job and in turn his wife, January Jones. And we watch this man's mental integrity start to slip away. Unlike Eye in the Sky, which was a tense chamber piece about the machinations of war and the conduct of war, Good Kill instead goes for the opposite direction in that it analyzes the psychological effect that it has on the people who fly the drones. And watching this guy, and in turn some of the other people, the colleagues that he works with, try and reconcile their job with what they're doing, it's quite fascinating. There's very little action in the film. There's a couple of staggering explosions, but there's quite a lot of emotional punch in it, and that's the heart of the film, I guess. Andrew Niccol, as we all know, is a very hit-and-miss filmmaker. For every great film he does, like Gattaca or Lord of War, he produces something that is just inexplicable, like Simone or In Time. I'm pleased to say that Good Kill falls very much in his better categories. Much like his protagonist in Ethan Hawke, the film is a very detached form of keeping the audience at bay. It's a very laconic, slow-moving film. It's quite ponderous, and it doesn't shy away from just sitting with this broken man as he tries in silence to put his life together in his head and sort his stuff out. Anyway, I'm not going to ramble for too much longer. Good Kill 2014, starring Ethan Hawke, January Jones, and directed by Andrew Niccol. Like I say, a couple of you might already know it, and that's great. I'm sure you enjoyed it as much as I do. I actually think it's a better film than Eye in the Sky. But for those who haven't seen it, it's definitely one of the best straight-to-DVD releases this country's had in the last couple of years, I think. And it's very worth a look. Now, back to Fake Shemp headquarters.
So there you go. Good Kill. That obscurity that every retailer seems to have bulk of.
That obscurity that surfaced on DVD and Blu-ray earlier this year through Roadshow, Home Entertainment.
No, but like, you know, I thought when Sean mentioned that film, I thought, that's not obscure because I look at that every day.
Yeah.
It sells every day.
Yeah.
But then when you listen to what he has to say, he's quite convincing.
It's almost a convincing argument.
It is fairly convincing. Yeah. And he's right. It flew under the shadow of Eye in the Sky. And I didn't even think about that. I haven't seen Good Kill, but I'm really, really keen to watch it now.
I'm actually quite keen to watch it now that I've got it sitting there and it's got Ethan Hawke in it. And generally I watch pretty much everything Ethan Hawke's in. But now I'm even keener since Sean's given it two thumbs up and said it's the better of the two films. We both liked Eye in the Sky.
So, cool. All right, what about you? Have you bought an obscurity in this party? Which one, sir? Is it?
Are we going to play the guessing game? I'll give you a bone.
Why not? Do you reckon I'll get it?
Probably.
Okay.
Maybe. It's from 1993.
Yeah.
It was produced by New Line Cinema. Isn't that weird?
It's a New Line film. It's in what year?
1993.
Oh, okay.
And it's got Cary Elwes in it. And it's got, what's his name? What's old mate from, I can't believe
that. Is that how you pronounce his surname?
Elwes?
Yeah. Elwes.
I think it's Cary Elwes. Yeah.
Oh, there's so many names that.
I think it just is Elwes. Elwes. Elwes.
All right. Him?
Yeah, that dude.
Yeah.
I like that you didn't say it. I'll just, in case I'm mispronouncing. Sorry, Cary. It's also got, eluding me now, the father from the 70s show, RoboCop.
Yeah.
That guy. What's his name? No, it's eluding you too.
Yeah.
Because I did play.
He's always just that guy that's in everything. You know?
Usually always looks sinister.
Shit.
You know, can you fly like a bird?
What was he in around that time?
And what was that? Okay, so who else? I don't want to give you the lead, but it's a female actress.
I may as well just give it to me.
Okay, you asked for it. okay, so the film is The Crush.
The Crush.
From 1993.
Yeah, remember this movie? Right. Yeah.
Okay, so let me go into my diary.
Hang on, The Crush is Alicia Silverstone.
Alicia Silverstone.
Yeah, right.
Now, this is Alicia Silverstone's debut feature film, following a one-off appearance on The Wonder Years, and a rather unforgettable saucy role in an Aerosmith music video for Crying, Crying. In fact, there was part of a trilogy of Aerosmith music videos around the time there. She did Crazy.
Yeah.
And there was another one, the fucking virtual reality one. What was it? It was, I don't know. There was amazing.
Oh,
and it's a shitty virtual reality. It was one of the first music videos.
I would love to have seen her in the Pink video, you know, that song they did Pink.
A song they did Pink?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, Sink the Pink?
No. There's an Aerosmith song called Pink.
Oh,
Pink
yes.
Pink is my favourite colour.
So I was thinking of Sink the Pink. Is that an AC/DC song? I don't know. I don't
listen
to it.
That's the porno you watched last night.
It was a home movie, Glenn. Sorry, Danny. That's not true. God. So, Aerosmith aside, Silverstone actually won the Best Breakthrough Performance at the 1994 TV movie. It was Silverstone. Silverstone? Silverstone is a punk rock band that plays shitty screamo music.
Okay.
And I was singing their music earlier to my dog. They are shit, though. But yeah, she won the 1994...
It's good to have a What the Fuck podcast that surrounds a What the Fuck
podcast. I was singing to my dog earlier this evening some screamo from the early 2000s. So she won the 1994 Best Breakthrough Performance, and she fucking deserved it.
Yeah.
So anyway, let me tell you a bit about the story.
Sure.
So Silverstone plays Darian, a 14-year-old girl. Now relax, folks. Well, maybe not. She was actually 17 years old at the time, so that makes it all right. Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah. Not really.
Yeah.
Not really.
Yeah.
Not really. But kind of, okay. Anyway, so she was 17 when she made it. In any case, Darian, the 14-year-old, forms a lasting...
But even though she's 17, you can just visualise her as 14, if you want.
Yeah. Well, they definitely portray her as a 14-year-old.
Mm.
They say that she's a 14-year-old a lot throughout the film.
Because she's supposed to be 14.
She plays a 14-year-old.
Yes.
Okay, so yeah, I'll continue. Darian, the 14-year-old, forms a lusty and dangerous obsession for Nick, which is played by the Princess Bride's Carrie Ells, we think it's Ells, who is renting Darian's parents' guest house. The only problem is Nick is a grown man. He's a 30-year-old man.
Oh,
so
for 1 litre.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And the problem with this strange sort of little obsession is that Nick reciprocates a little bit of the feeling. He, you know, I think he finds it a bit endearing.
Mm.
So he actually gives her a bit of a kiss. And that's where shit goes off the rails, my good man. Darian's driven by a naive desire and rampaging adolescent hormones. She goes full bunny boiler on Nick, both relentlessly and recklessly endangering everyone and anyone.
Yes, it's all coming back to me. Yeah.
It's a beautiful film. But it's far from original, I'll tell you, Glenn. We've seen this Lolita meets Fatal Attraction scenario countless times before. But outside of Kubrick's Lolita, and was it Adrian Lynn who did the...
Fatal Attraction?
No, he did the Lolita remake,
yes,
though, too.
Yes,
yeah,
he's got an obsession 90s. With those sort of subjects.
He does, doesn't he?
We've had that discussion on the podcast.
Yeah, in fact, it has come up.
Yeah.
So, yeah, outside of, say, few films have sexualized a 14-year-old girl quite as much as The Crush has. And this, in a way, is one of its greatest strengths. But I'm not advocating it's a good thing. I'm just sort of saying it set it apart from the deluge of similar films.
What about My Girl?
No, there's no...
Number two? Where she started getting horny?
But she's hanging out with the kid from Last Action Hero, though. She's not fucking Dan Aykroyd. I mean, Dan Aykroyd's a dad. That would be weird. That'd be real weird. But no, like I mean, sexualizing.
Yeah,
like,
I know.
You know, she's really seductive, laying on the lawn in her, you know, bikinis and
style.
Stuff like. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's like, yeah, totally like Drew Barrymore, because that was like one of those roles. You're like, fucking, that's one way to break it.
Mm.
You know, how we've typecast you, even though you can't play those roles anymore. But anyway, moving on. Undoubtedly, the greatest strength, Alicia Silverstone mentioned the MTV winning that role. And that's because this is like the polar opposite role to what would make her famous 2 years later as Cher. That was like the career-defining role. These are two completely different roles.
Yeah.
And I think the strength of that is the fact that she's a bit of a force of nature. You feel terrified for the fact that you feel kind of, you know, attracted to her. She's quite alluring.
Yeah.
But then also her menacing side is terrifying
as well.
So
it kind of plays on the audience. You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
it
right.
really sort of shifts the gears around. But... screenwriter-director Alan Shapiro is careful in his sexualization of Darian, though he attempts to make her seem mature beyond her years, at least intellect-wise. She has that, like, Ivy League sort of sensibility. And that's, you know, the pitfall for Nick, because I think he sort of sees her as a bit of an equal.
Yep.
In addition to that, that attraction as such. Filmmaker Shapiro, outside of this film, only wrote and directed two other features, worked on a bunch of TV movies, but the two features he did were two family films, 86's The Christmas Star and 96's Flipper, which had Paul Hogan and Elijah Wood.
Yes.
I think from memory too. Yeah.
I thought about that film last week.
Well, I've never seen Flipper.
Yeah.
I remember coming out of the movies, and it was when Paul Hogan had all that plastic surgery, so he didn't look like Paul Hogan anymore.
Because I watched that that sort of doco called Hanging with Hogs. It's on Netflix.
Ah, right.
And
any good?
It's okay. It's good to catch up with him now and actually hear from him what he's doing and all that. But and I just thought about Flipper, like, because I liked Paul Hogan a lot back in the day.
I did too. Well, I
Almost
really
an Angel is great.
Oh, it's great.
Yeah.
Lightning Jack, I remember
underrated.
Thinking was a great film. Yeah. I haven't seen it for many years. Cuba Gooding Jr. was a mute in it.
Yeah. He shoots himself in the foot.
And was it Renee Russo that was the female lead or?
Oh, no, Beverly D'Angelo.
Beverly D'Angelo.
Yes.
Right. That was before she got all the work too.
Yeah, well, kind of.
Well, in the middle of the getting the work.
We digress.
Indeed we do. Look, The Crush is cliched as it's fun. It requires a generous amount of suspension in disbelief, but ultimately it's bubbly and sinister. A nice take on teenage obsession. Now, it's arguable as to how obscure the film is, but when most folk talk Alicia Silverstone, obviously they always talk about, like, you know, they'll talk about Clueless, but they may even talk about, like, Excess Fucking Baggage.
Yeah.
Or clearly Batgirl. Yeah. But my sort of, you know, argument for it being obscure is my wife is a massive Clueless fan, loved it growing up as a kid. She had never even heard of this film before I put it to her. Hey, do you want to have a look at this? So, look, if you're keen to give it a geeze, you can pick it up for about...
It's true. It's a film of its time, and it's kind of stuck in its time. Like, it's sort of, it's been left behind.
Totally.
Yeah.
It's a sad truth. And I didn't know, like, at least in Brisbane, I don't think it went theatrical, but I had a look at the classification board, and it turns out it did get rated for cinemas as well as home on the same date. So I don't know if it actually did go theatrical or not. I mean, it is an odd duck of a film, but... You can buy it for about $6.98 at JB Hi-Fi.
It's got a really weird pinkish cover.
Yeah, with the sunglasses and the reflection of Carrie Ells and the sunglasses. I've got the Screen Factory Blu-ray. Carrie Ells, I believe. I think that's how it's pronounced. No one gives a shit. Except for the Carrie Ells fans out there. We apologise. I did have a really good line that I wrote down about, like, Alicia Silverstone wanting a taste of, like, the Wesley Wagyu beefcake. I just remember that. I can't find where it is in the page here, but, like, I just remember it. And it was like, I'm just going to reference the character from Princess Bride. I'm like, is anyone going to get that? Who knows? Anyway, that's my obscurity. Glenn, tell me what you're bringing.
Boom.
Can I have a little guess at what
it is? All right, cool. Well, I'm going to say that this kind of ties in with our focus film in the fact that it's another what-the-fuck kind of movie.
Right. Was it produced by New Line Cinema?
I do not know. It wouldn't surprise me, but I doubt it. Think... If David Lynch and Terry Gilliam had co-directed a freak show episode of Tales from the Crypt.
Right.
Okay. It is one of those really twisted things. It's an R-rated film. I think in Australia it was R-rated.
Right. Boxing Helena.
No.
And that's not very Tales from the Crypt.
If I read out the cast minus the lead actor.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so...
Oh, hang on. Do we have a year? Am I getting a year?
1991.
God, that was a good year.
Okay,
for
so we've got Wayne Newton. We've got Rob Lowe, we've got James Caan, we've got Lara Flynn Boyle, and we've got Bill Paxton. That's a fucking awesome cast.
That's a lot of people. That's a lot of people.
Do you want the lead actor?
Lara Flynn Boyle, 91. So that was like in the midst of Twin Peaks.
It was, and this is a very Lynchy kind of film.
Yeah, give us the lead.
Judd Nelson. In his absolute, undeniable best role.
Relentless?
No.
That way you would have done
directed
that
by? Time. Adam Rifkin, who did Detroit Rock City, The Chase, Homo Erectus.
Jesus, what was it?
The Dark Backwood.
I've never seen this movie.
You might know the poster.
It is obscure.
This is a fucking stunning film.
Judd Nelson.
Okay,
too.
Let me give you the synopsis. Judd Nelson plays a garbage man who moonlights as a bad stand-up comedian.
Right.
And with the encouragement from his self-obsessed best friend, who's Bill Paxton, being Bill Paxton at his best, he attempts to take the comedy career to the next level, and then he suddenly begins to grow a third arm out of his back.
What the fuck?
And all of a sudden he becomes an overnight sensation and ends up being the new wonder of the world because he's got three arms and it's a fully functioning...
Makes sense why Wayne Newton's in this film then.
Wayne Newton plays one of his agents. James Caan also plays another agent. But it is a really surreal and really, really grotesque film. It's absurdist filmmaking, brilliant production design. Very small production design. It's got a lot of... it's got really... explicit necrophilia in it, which is comical. It's truly outrageous. It's very fucked up, and the poster art is just delicious. I love it.
Fantastic. I'm gonna have to Google that.
Let me this. I'll load it onto my screen now. And tell me if you recognise it. And Adam Rifkin, like, it's the best thing he's ever done.
Right. Yeah.
There's the poster for you.
Oh, I do remember this. I think it was like first release or one of those Columbia TriStar labels that put it out on home end.
Yeah, it could have been. Oops.
I remember seeing the artwork for this around the same time as that The Vagrant. Did that have Bill Paxton? I think that's got Bill Paxton in as well.
One of the quotes on the poster says, reminiscent of Eraserhead, Pink Flamingos and Brazil.
Oh, brilliant.
So there you go.
That wasn't on our video cover. Surely I would have rented it if it said that.
Yeah, I know. So this is, there's not a lot to say that I haven't already said, but it's just one of these films that... I caught it really late at night when I was a kid. I think they aired it on ABC or SBS or one of those.
Right.
And then only recently I thought, I want to watch that again. And I found it online.
Actually, where was it?
Oh, I can't remember. It might have even been on YouTube but in an HD version. Because there is a Blu-ray out there, I think.
Right.
Which I'm going to have to order.
Because
I really want to own it. But I tell you what, I just fucking love this film. It holds up really well. Bill Paxton is that typical arrogant, loud Bill Paxton.
Right.
Like,
picking
from Weird Science.
Yeah.
That kind of character, which can grate on a lot of people. Be really annoying.
A bit like his role in True Lies as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That's actually probably a close
one. Plays that asshole quite well.
But Judd Nelson, he plays a really mild-mannered nerd. So he's got the glasses with that bit of tape in the middle.
Wow.
And he's really, really withdrawn. And he's this comedian that nothing he says is funny, right? He's a stand-up comedian that has no good jokes.
Yeah.
The only person in the crowd that laughs is Bill Paxton.
Right.
But Bill Paxton overdoes the laugh as if, like, you know, trying to pander to him. And you've got to check this one out.
I really want to see it. And I love Judd Nelson. And, I mean, like, what the fuck happened to Judd Nelson? So this was obviously around that time that he kind of dropped off the map. He did this, and I remember he did Relentless, where I think he was a serial killer. It was rated R.
That's
at the time.
Right, yeah.
And then we didn't really hear.
He's done a lot of television, I think, but not in lead roles, just more support roles. And I do think this is the best thing he's ever done.
Incredible.
Yeah, and for him to have a lead role in a film like this is quite something.
And to play against type too, because he's forever remembered as being the sort of dropout kind of high school
punk.
Bully punk kid. Yeah.
There you go. The Dark Backward.
I'm sitting here trying to figure out now which was the most disgusting scene in this picture. The one where the father eats the snake eggs? I don't think so. I don't think that was the worst. I'd have to say where you see the birth of a man out of a woman's womb. A full-grown man. That's really a nice scene.
All right, so that's it. That brings us to the end of another episode. Episode 30, I might add.
Incredible. We should be doing something special for this, like a nudie run around my local neighborhood.
Maybe.
It's pretty cold though, so maybe we'll save that for summer. We'll save it for the 35th anniversary.
Okay.
35th anniversary podcast.
All right. Well, I'm 40. Let's do it at 40.
Okay. Yeah. That's fair enough.
40 degrees, that is.
Oh, shit.
All right. Let's remind everybody about the Melbourne Underground Film Festival coming up September 16th. I mean, get along to the whole festival as well.
Absolutely.
Addison Heath's new film, The Perfect Nonsense, is opening the festival. And, you know, we've been big supporters of his work. So get along to that, but definitely get along to ours on September 16th. Come along, mingle with us. If you've never met us, come and say hi.
Come and have a beer.
The
Piston Heads might be out. I'm not sure if they're going to be out at this one.
There will be drinks for you.
Yeah, absolutely. We won't be serving them. You'll have to pay for them.
Yeah.
Or I'm willing to fill in, like, you know, a plastic cup in the bathroom for you. Not with urine, with tap water.
Yes.
You know, warm tap water.
Yes, can I have some of that?
Yes, sir. Yes, you may. Now, I just want to briefly touch on, because obviously some people might be coming to the screening. I just want to give them a heads up.
Yeah.
If you come into the screening, what my pet peeves are for, you know, attending movies and dealing with other cinema patrons. I saw Nerve the other night. I know that we discussed it earlier. We both quite like this film for what it is. And my pet peeve, you know, people eat during movies. I can kind of tolerate that. You know, people pull their phones out. I fucking hate it.
I fucking hate
it. Hate it. It's, it, you know, we've said before, it's a huge distraction. Like, suddenly there's an extra light and it draws your eyes and it's hard. And people that generally pull the phone out once during the movie are pulling out several times during the movie. It happened during The Shallows the other week. And that was probably one of the most exciting things that happened in The Shallows. But my pet peeve, which I witnessed at Nerve the other night, I didn't actually see it to start with. Danny pointed out, she goes, oh, you won't like this, and taps me. And some fucking troll has taken off their shoes and put their bare feet on top of the seats.
Are you fucking joking?
No, it happens
joking.
All the fucking time.
That happens
time.
To you a lot.
All the time, man. And I fucking, I don't even really hate feet, but I don't want them anywhere near where I put my fucking head.
No.
And to make matters worse, well, this is my simple way of combating it, because you can't stop these people from putting their feet. You could, you know, say, you know, get your fucking feet down. And I have yelled things in the past to get so angry about
them. Do you tickle them?
And yell them out. I don't get remotely near them.
Okay.
But no, I always buy tickets in the back row center. Always. I mean, since I got my glasses, it makes it easy to see. But that way I know no motherfuckers ever had their dirty, filthy fucking feet on the back of my seat. See, it drives me so angry. That's why I'm swearing, Glenn. I don't usually get this angry, but it just riles me up something. I really don't like it. And sometimes you see them hanging out in pairs and they've got their dirty feet out together.
You know what? I've never, ever had that happen to me.
It's so gross, man. You know what I'm thinking about doing? And I've been thinking about it for a while, but you know when you think of something like half way through and you think about all the things you missed, I want to start documenting it, because I think you should be able to shame people that do that shit in a cinema, because it's just basic courtesy. You know, you can do a lot of things in the cinema and I'll let it get, you know, you can get away with that if you want to, you know, fuck over in the left-hand corner, as long as you're quiet.
Yeah.
You know,
as long as you don't disturb me.
Yeah, exactly. If you don't disturb me, that's fine, but I don't want to see you putting your filthy feet on.
So this is a documentary you're going to make called Feet on Seats.
No, I'm just going to take photos of people and then maybe start an Instagram account. Yeah. And just be like, and I put the session time, the cinema, and I take a photo, and then I'll even try and work out what seat number maybe they're in. Oh. I don't know. I'm probably not going to do this, but putting it out there, you can maybe call someone else will be inspired to do it.
It'll be like a series. You can call it Filthy Fucking Cunt. Yeah. Like, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I told you that when I went and saw Star Trek, and, you know, I did see Star Trek. When I went and saw Star Wars, that, you know, I was super excited to see it. I saw it on the Thursday night. I didn't go to the midnight session like yourself, but I went and saw that movie. And the dude next to me didn't have his feet on the seats, but had taken off his shoes and had his leg crossed and was picking at the bottom of his foot, and the foot was facing me. So I took my shoe off and I put it on the handrest between us and just put it there facing him, like the dirty, you know, pole end out toward him. And he gave me this weird look and I said, oh, sorry, mate. I thought we were just taking off our shoes and getting comfortable. And yeah, that guy put his shoes on pretty fast and pointed that foot away from me.
Fucking great.
But anyway, feet, I fucking hate them. And they have no place in a cinema except for on the ground in a pair of shoes. If you're coming along to Muff, please, please keep your shoes on, for the love of God. And I don't know what's the deal with ushers these days. Like, I know, you know, you can go, oh yeah, they don't get paid much and they're kids. Well, I was a fucking usher and I was a kid. I had to go in there plenty of times and just general, you know, get your feet off the seats. Back then, people at least had a little bit of common decency and they'd put their shoes on the seats.
Yeah.
I'd even rather your shoe on the seat than your dirty fucking foot, and your shoes touch the ground, but I don't know where your feet have been. I'm just going off of feet. But anyway, ushers suck because they should be doing shit.
Do you know what ushers are the worst? The ushers at the Melbourne International Film Festival.
But aren't they the volunteers though?
Yeah, but they're motherfuckers.
You're going to slam the volunteers.
I'm going to slam the volunteers because they will come in after the film started to usher people that rock up late who shouldn't fucking be there.
And they put the
there.
Fucking lights on.
They put their torches on and shine it in your eyes while you're trying to watch.
There's two seats over here.
Oh, there's five people in front of you, so I'll just shine this torch in their fucking faces.
Absolutely. They're like... they're like the rookie fucking ushers that are like, oh, I'll take the volunteer job because I want to be involved in the festival. And great, because they are and they're helping out. But it's like, this is the only time they're doing it. And, you know.
They haven't been schooled.
They haven't been schooled and there's no common sense. It's like, you've never been, you want to work at the film festival. So obviously you like films, you like going to movies, yeah? Have you ever gone to a movie and had a torch shone in your fucking
That's
face?
That's right. You've obviously never been a patron.
No, exactly.
Like, what the fuck?
Yeah. Anyway, so, I don't know. These are some of our pet peeves. Well,
sure.
Yeah.
We should maybe use that as a nice way to end the show.
Absolutely. Keep your feet in your shoes and your shoes on the ground, and we'll see you
at the Melbourne Underground Film Festival. Anyway, thank you for listening. It's been an absolute pleasure. Get well soon, Sean.
Get well. Now, I didn't come off like a prick or anything. I just get riled up. That's all. I'm sorry. I get real angry.
But you are a prick.
I'm very nice to small animals. I love animals. What can I say? Thank you, Glenn.